Now, if you've been following, to the best of our knowledge, the last few months, you know we're collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story. Some people call it the This American Life of Israel. It's now entering its second season in Hebrew. It's one of the most popular radio shows in Israel, and especially now, with so much depressing news coming from that region, it brings stories that try to humanize and also complicate things. Here's Israel Story's host, Mishi Harman, with a story he produced for us.
We always think that fake and real are opposites. You know, if something is fake, by definition, it isn't real, and vice versa. But, well, the story of Moshe Moses Wilhelm Shapira shows us that sometimes reality is just much more complicated than that. I didn't know it when I began researching the story, but the Shapira affair, or Shapiromania as many of the people I talk to call it, continues to stir up really intense emotions, even though it took place more than 130 years ago. Case in point, Micha Shagrir, a Jerusalemite filmmaker.
I'm following for many, many years. I am like a secret detective. Every day I think about him, or I do something that is related to his story. I go with him everywhere, and he is with me in the archives, in the libraries, in Europe, in Israel, in Australia.
Without a single exception, when I called all the people I talked to for this piece, collectors, professors, curators, archaeologists, documentary filmmakers, and told them that I wanted to talk about Shapira, they had the exact same response. Oho, Shapira, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. And when I showed up at their houses to record, everyone, but everyone, asked me to wait a second, and appeared a few minutes later holding a stack of heavy folders full of pictures, newspaper clippings, articles, books, and documents bursting out from every side.
You want to see the object of Shapira? I will show you. Here you see one of his heads. Here's the scrolls.
And here, for example, a photograph of Miriam, his daughter, and that's Rosetta, the mother, and that's Mr. Shapira himself, the only picture of him that I found till now.
It became completely clear to me that the Shapira affair was very far from being settled. So what are we talking about? In 1855, Moshe Shapira, a good Jew from an Orthodox family, left his home in the little Ukrainian village of Kamenets Podolsky and set off on a long journey with his grandfather. They were going to the Holy Land, where, rumors had it, the Messiah was about to make an appearance. En route, somewhere in Romania, the grandpa died, and Shapira started mingling with all kinds of types. Most of them were representatives of an organization with a really catchy name, the London Society for Promoting Christianity Amongst the Jews. They promised him, with all their might, that the Messiah had actually already come, and that his name was Jesus. Moshe was slowly convinced, and when he arrived in Jerusalem a year later, he was a Christian, and his name was now Moses Wilhelm. In Jerusalem, he joined a small community of Protestants and converted Jews.
My name is Rechav Rubin, and I'm known by most friends as Buni.
Buni is a professor of geography at the Hebrew University.
Well, there was in Jerusalem a group, kind of a social community of European people. Some of them were missionaries, others were scholars who were involved in the study of the history of the Holy Land.
But Shapira wasn't really interested in the mission, or, for that matter, in research. He wanted to be a businessman, so he opened up a small souvenir shop in the Christian quarter of the Old City in Jerusalem. Irit Salman, a true Shapirologist, who even curated an exhibit about him, explains.
Well, he had one of the first shops of antiquity in Jerusalem. So he sold everything which he could to the tourists. He sold Bibles, he sold dried flowers from the Holy Land, which the German pilgrims liked very much, and memorabilia from any kind. And he sold, as a matter of fact, the illusion that they touch history, because they grew on the Bible and on the New Testament, and all of a sudden they hold in their hands something which maybe also Jesus Christ kept it. So It was very, very strong.
In addition to those kinds of souvenirs, which still fill the shops of the old city, Shapira also began selling antiquities that Bedouins from the area found and brought to him. His shop was a huge hit, and he became one of the best-known merchants in town.
It was a very famous shop. It was even written on the front of the shop that he is the representative of the British Museum, not just a regular shop. In the Baedeker tourist guide from the 19th century, it was written that this is the best antique shop in Palestine.
Shapira's life, as we say in Israel, was dvash, all honey. He married Rosetta, a devout German nurse. They had two girls, Augusta and Miriam, and his business was booming. And then, one hot summer day in August 1868, a discovery made in Divan, east of the Jordan River, changed his life. Local Bedouins had found a large basalt stone, inscribed with markings that sort of looked like footprints of a chicken. Shapira rushed to see the stone, as did another archaeology enthusiast, a young French diplomat by the name of Charles Clermont Ganot, who would, very quickly, turn out to be Shapira's arch-nemesis. It seemed odd to the Bedouins that all these distinguished Europeans were so excited about the rock and were fighting amongst themselves over who would pay a higher price for it. They were sure it had to contain some valuable treasure inside. So, one night, they rolled the stone into a bonfire, poured cold water over it, and smashed it to smithereens. They were pretty disappointed. The crazy Europeans, it seemed, had been fighting over a plain black rock. No treasure. But Clermont Ganot had had his aide copy the inscriptions before it was smashed. And when he deciphered the lines, it turned out it really was a treasure. The 34 lines on the Meshas Stili, that's what they call the stone, described a series of wars between the king of Moab and the Israelites. The exact same war described in the second book of Kings. Now, that might not sound super exciting today, but this was one of the very earliest external, independent accounts that verified a biblical tale. The craze around finding archaeological proof of the Bible began. Everyone wanted Moabite artifacts.
Very soon, a tourist guide, Arabic tourist guide, came to him after he opened the shop and made him an offer he couldn't resist. He said, "Whatever you sell to the tourists during the day, I can complete during the night," which means to make fakes.
Here's Buni Rubin, the geographer.
Well, we don't know for sure. I can only make a guess that if the demand was going up and up and up, and buyers could offer a lot of money, and they had a fairly lower ability to assess the authenticity or the quality of the antiquities, then a businessman like Shapira wanted to have enough stock in his shop in order to supply this demand for antiques. So I guess if he couldn't get enough antiques from proper sources or kosher pieces, then it may well be that he thought how to supply this demand by producing or actually faking them.
Shapira saw the Moabite letters on the Meshas Stili.
And very soon in the market started to appear clay pieces with unknown letters that nobody could read, which means he created a new culture, which called Moabitica. He liked it very much, and he started to get from the Bedouin who used to cross the Jordan and to bring all kind of antiques, part of them authentic.
Almost overnight, Shapira's collection of Moabite clay artifacts became famous all over the world. Articles were written about it, new theories were based on it, people said the collection was priceless, and Shapira himself became a major celebrity within the antiquities world. But if you look at Shapira's fakes today, even if you know nothing about archaeology, they look like something that a fifth grader made in an arts and crafts workshop.
today, when we look at those pieces, it looks so clumsy and so unprofessional, all the sticked letters or the sculptures of head of people from stone, from clay. They look so strange because nowhere there are pieces like that or heads like that or pieces of archaeology like that. That's why it was so easy to sell those objects, because today, if you look at it, I look at it, not professional, we would say, this is a fake. But at that time, nobody knew it, so nobody could identify it. Everybody wanted to believe.
And Shapira totally took advantage of that willingness to believe. In 1873, he convinced the archaeological museum in Berlin, the Altes Museum, to buy 1,700 pieces from his collection.
For those who were skeptic, he invited to come with him to an expedition, and he took them to the desert or to Transjordan, and the Bedouins prepared for him in advance the area where he used to take them, as if they are going to excavate. And they just scratched the ground and they found pieces of pottery and archaeologic remains, and he prepared the visit very, very well.
The only problem with Shapira's pieces was that they were, we've seen, completely bogus. But even today, there are people who don't exactly see them that way. Uri Katz, a collector of Shapira fakes, for example, has a soft spot for Shapira, as kind of an original maverick or biblical outsider artist or something like that.
The artifacts that he was selling were really something new. It was not a copy of anything which we knew before. A Shapira or whoever made the artifacts were some people of some originality, because they invented the artifacts. They invented the shape and whatever. He created something new in some way.
Micha, who we heard at the very beginning and who is in the middle of shooting a documentary film about Shapira, basically agrees.
No, he was not a chronicle swindler. He was not a real swindler, but yes, he had his tricks.
Of course, the man who proved to the experts in Berlin that these were all fakes was none other than Shapira's biggest rival, Clermont Ganneau, making him a polarizing figure among the Shapira underground. Some adore him. Others actually told me, and this is a quote, that they despise him. In any event, once the forgery was discovered, Shapira and his collection became sort of a laughingstock. He returned to his shop and to the simple, silly souvenirs. A few years later, Shapira came out with a declaration that immediately rocked the entire world. He claimed that he held 17 parchment scrolls inscribed with an unknown version of the Book of Deuteronomy, the final book of the Torah, written in an early Hebrew script. Perhaps these were the original scrolls that Moses received from God, he hinted. Or maybe a version written down at the time of Jesus by a retiring sect in the Judean desert, where, he said, the Bedouins who brought him the scrolls had found them. Obviously, this was huge. The Book of Deuteronomy, maybe Moses' own personal copy. But there was one even more mind-blowing surprise. Here's Micha, the filmmaker.
In the book that Shapira brought, there are 11 commandments. What is the 11th? Do love your friend as you love yourself. Love thy neighbor. What does it mean? Is it a very Jewish version, or is it a very Christian version?
He toured all of Europe with his scrolls, and you gotta understand, this was front page news in all the biggest newspapers around the continent for an entire year. The whole world, it seemed, was following the saga of Shapira and his precious scrolls.
He brought it to the German, and the German, as you remember, bought already 1,700 fake pieces from him. And after a few months, they thought about it and they decided not to buy it. And then he came to the British Museum. They believed him. The British were very excited from it because they loved the Bible.
Two of the scrolls were exhibited to the excited public, who queued up for hours to get a peek. Even the British Prime Minister, Gladstone, came to see them and tried to help raise the funds.
The sum of money asked was unbelievable. Million sterling in 1883. Today, it's also a lot of money, but then it was, phew. In fact, he said to his daughter before he went to his last journey, "When I come back, you will be the richest girl in the world."
But then, of course, our French friend, Clermont Ganneau, rushed over from Paris.
Despite the fact that there was no tunnel and no fast train, but it was fast enough from one day to the other. Clermont Ganneau came, he looked at the scrolls, and then he said, this is forgery.
And then they come back to him and say, "No business. We found your past. You are a forger. We even checked the text and the scrolls themselves. A forgery."
It's the most chutzpahdik fake in the history.
Yes.
The British press was wild. The story was everywhere. They didn't stop to write about it day and night in all the newspapers.
The English got cold feet, and they told Shapira, "Sorry, we do not take the scrolls."
Even for a tough survivor like Shapira, this was a really hard hit.
He went from place to place, from country to country, all over Europe, and in March 84, he arrived to a small hotel in Rotterdam and committed suicide.
And what happened to the scrolls that caused a worldwide frenzy and were nearly sold for £1 million?
The scroll afterwards was sold in a fair to a collector who bought it for 16 sterling. And they say that his library was burned and they were never found.
End of story? Well, not exactly. A little more than 60 years after Shapira killed himself in that Rotterdam motel, disgraced, humiliated, and penniless, a Bedouin shepherd, Muhammad Adib, was out grazing his flock near Qumran in the north of the Dead Sea. When one of his sheep ran into a cave and wouldn't come back, the shepherd threw a little rock which hit something that made a strange sound. That's how the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Exactly in the same area where Shapira claimed that the Bedouins had found his scrolls. A new, completely horrifying possibility emerged. Could it be that Shapira's scrolls, that were maligned and destroyed, were real after all?
To be really honest, there is a small, a tiny, like this, what if? And what if these pieces, which are lost now, were not faked? What if part of them was authentic? Then we lost something which might have been very, very important. How can we know? How can we ever know how to deal, how to work out this tiny little what if? The tiny what if, I think, will be an open question for forever. We'll never know. And the what if will stand, I guess.
In one final ironic twist that only a forger like Shapira would really appreciate, his fakes have now themselves become very valuable collector's items. In fact, today people talk of real Shapira fakes. And that's what Irit Salman called her exhibit about him. Truly fake.
I think it's a great name. In English, it's truly fake. And in Hebrew, Ziyuf Amiti, because it was really fake. So it's a real fake.
And who knows? Maybe somewhere in a backroom workshop of a souvenir store in the narrow streets of Jerusalem's bustling Christian quarter, someone right now is sitting down and making fake Shapira fakes.
Mishi Harman is the founder, producer, and host of Israel Story. You can read about Mishi and listen to more of his pieces on our website, ttbook.org. And if you like them, be sure to tune in to Israel Story's first season in English on the Vox Tablet podcast beginning August 18th.